in the development of this being, those manifestations of its own consciousness, which are primary, first come into manifestation after itself. It gradually turns creation over to these secondary powers, for the only way that it can release them is to go to sleep in them. Therefore, we have the great problem, which has oppressed theologians for thousands of years, and that is the Trinity, or the triad of creating powers in India, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. In this particular symbolism, of course, as we know, the supreme power goes to sleep as far as its unity is concerned and becomes aware of itself in its three creating aspects as a trinity. It has no longer the full conscious awareness of its own unity, because this unity is absorbed into three points of individualized consciousness, which constitute the triad or symbol of equilibrium. These three become the creative power, that is the power that is actually to become the beginning and ruler of all the processes of creativity. The second is to become the protective, the preservative, and the enlightening power. And the third is to become the reproductive and ultimately destructive power of crystallization or transformation, by means of which the entire pattern is prevented from ever being captured in an eternal likeness. In other words, the third power of your creator is the power that prevents the ultimate turning of the solar system into stone and locking within it every form of life that is there. Therefore, as the processes of nature decline, then your disintegrating power breaks up the compounds. The creating power, of course, is Brahma, and in India, the preserving, protecting, and perpetuating power is Vishnu, and the power which breaks up crystallization by transformation is Shiva, the eternal mendicant, always dressed in wild garments of an ascetic, body covered with clay, sitting alone in meditation on the snowy peaks of Himavat. The principle, however, is that three agencies now take over. And these three agencies, in taking over, in turn release those hierarchs or orders of life which are locked within their consciousness. And each one, as it unlocks the powers within it, releasing orders of existence, goes to sleep in these orders of existence. Thus Vishnu, the preserver, in releasing the 10 avatars, goes to sleep in the 10 embodiments of itself. And all this process continues, in which the continuous involutionary process, by means of which the solar system is finally brought into the condition which we might recognize today, is always a process of consciousness going to sleep in embodiment, always a process of unities being broken up into diversities, always a process of a single consciousness losing its nature of identity and becoming divided consciousness. So we finally reach the nadir of this situation, the greatest possible descent of the deity into manifestation. And at that point, we have the universe of infinite diversity. We have the universe in which every fragment appears to be completely isolated, in which every substance and essence has its own life and its own purpose, in which there are infinite and countless manifestations of creatures and creations, where there is no longer any communion between these creatures, except perhaps such communion as comes through instinct or intuition. We have then the universe as, or the solar system as we see it today. We have a solar system with countless forms of vegetation, with innumerable types of insects and fishes and birds, mammals of all kinds, flowers, trees. We have even the magnificent evolving processes in the crystallization of rocks. And we have, perhaps above them all, the mysterious power of man himself, who has also a manifestation of this infinite division of consciousness. Now, the ancients gave to the Trinity, or the basic creating triad of beings, the power to fashion out of the chaotic elements within the alchemical vessel, the great formula of life itself. And this process goes on, and the medieval alchemists transformed the entire creation of the universe, the solar system, man, and the human soul into chemical equations. And the study of all these equations is a very fascinating thing, because it finally breaks down again to a highly evolved system of abstract philosophical chemistry. But for all practical purposes, we can't follow every step of the way. We know that as surely as the various powers emerge in their own development, that we will find also the emergence of the planetary system. We find that from the sovereignty of the sun's consciousness will come forth the consciousness of planets. That these planets are miniatures of the solar system, each beginning with a magnetic field within the greater field, each with its own Mount Nero at its northern pole, each therefore producing from itself a recapitulation of the seven continents, the seven great oceans, the seven orders of life, beginning with the mineral, and finally the seven basic races of men. All of these septenaries arise from the same septenary principle that brought forth the creation of the worlds in the first place. We have your musical harmony, your chemical affinities, and all these things paralleling this ancient system in every possible respect. We may later, as time goes on, be able to refine or improve some of the minor phases of it, but the great principle involved is not likely to be changed, because man has never conceived anything since that was as stupendous and yet as logical in terms of common human experience as that which was developed by the sages of ancient India, Egypt, China, and Greece. These were the great thinkers of the primordial world of man's experience. So gradually this mysterious globe in space begins to fill. It fills in many ways. The Gnostics pointed out that gradually, as the result of this development, a new center was established. This new center, as it came into existence, was necessary in order that the physical world might be generated. This center, like the original one, is not in dead center of the egg, but above the center, but not at the outer, at top, as in the case of the primordial center. In man, three centers are recognized as coming into existence: the heart, or spiritual core, and the brain and the reproductive system. These three become man's manifestation of the three deities. And in the creation of the solar system, these also come into manifestation. The next thing that we find is that near the center of this great circle or sphere that we have set up, there descends from above, from the imperishable center, a new or extension of life, which moves into a central point. And in this central point, it draws from the entire area of the sphere all of the impregnated energy that is in a solar system is drawn from the circumference by a mysterious spiritual attraction until it gathers into a point near the center of the solar sphere, or this mysterious crystalline bubble in which we find the process taking place. Excuse my inadequacy in language, but some of these are rather taxing to find words for. In any event, the center, having been established by privating, as Jacob Bamies calls it, privating the entire interior of the egg, everything moves to the center to cause something that resembles the yolk of the egg. In the Greek, we have the same principle in the symbolism of the shield of Helios, the sun deity. The area of the circular shield is the egg. The central boss or knob represents the condensation of the spiritual power to a center. And as the energy is all drawn to this center, what is left is called the privation. This is the part that is deprivated of life. This becomes what Bamy calls the great hunger. It is that which cries for life. It is told in the Gnostic series that the great mother cried out that she might give birth. And this great mother represents the field of the egg after it has been deprived by the central energy, which moves to the center and there forms by a tremendous psychic compression the magnetic body of the sun. The sun, therefore, is the energy of the entire area set aside for a solar system. The sun becomes sovereign of that part which lies within the wall of the egg. Beyond the wall of the egg, the sun has no further sovereignty. And outside of the solar system, beyond a certain point, the sun no longer exercises any influence. It may be seen, it sends its own little ray across space, but it has no proprietorship over the evolutionary process. And if a ray of the sun or of some other sun in space goes forth like the ray of a fixed star which has been captured in sound and color by modern equipment, if this ray reaches out and maybe goes across 1,000 solar systems to be recorded by some instrument that we have, this ray, however, does not fertilize. It does not cause any creation in this outside area, only within its own field of manifestation. Once the central sun is therefore created, we come again to the Pythagorean and Ptolemaic theory. In their theory, the egg of the solar system was represented by a circle within which were the concentric rings of the planetary orbits. But at this time, the planetary orbits do not exist. The time we are referring to, the hypothetical boundary of the solar system is represented by a belt of stars. Inside of this, material is gradually drawn to the center by privation. And to indicate that, the ancients established the orbits of the planets to signify the 7 degrees of privation. The orbit of Saturn was fashioned first, being that which is the furthest from the sun. And therefore, Saturn is the eldest of the gods. And he is also the god that must destroy or devour all his own creation. His orbit being the most remote represents, therefore, that which is the first to be fashioned and, incidentally, will be the last to be compensated or overcome. And Milton says that death is the last great enemy. So that in the development of this theory, the orbits are formed by the retiring of the energy degree by degree towards center, producing first the orbit of Saturn, then of Jupiter, then of Mars, then the ancient concept of the orbit of the sun, which was, however, a cover for another planet which they did not know. And later, after that, the orbit of Venus and of Mercury and the orbit of the moon, which was the closest to the Earth. They had their own little private system of astronomy, but the concept is that the Earth to them was the physical body corresponding to the human heart, which was set up in the midst of the planets, and around which, in this case, the sun, as a superior energy, also rotated. But in any event, the Egyptians tell us that the gathering of the 7 degrees of substance was from the circumference to the center, leaving the orbits like the concentric rings of an onion, which the Egyptians held to be a sacred vegetable because it revealed this mystery. When the energy had all reached the sun, then, at that moment, the physical structure of the solar system was born. At that time, all energy had been contracted, and in this energy field, the solar logos came into embodiment. It was then the quickening, and from that time on, the power of the solar principle was no longer operating from outside, from above, or with a conscious, separate understanding of the creative process. It then incarnated, according to the ancients, in the sun itself, and began the great evolutionary part of its existence. Having gathered all its resources to achieve birth, it now achieved maturity of embodiment by gradually releasing these resources into the vacuum that had been left by the retirement of energy in the first place. It therefore began to fill the privation around it with energy which had passed through and been conditioned by its own consciousness. And from this came the orbits and bodies of the planets as we know them, to become the embodiments of the seven loboi, or the seven bowels, or the seven Elohim of the first chapter of Genesis, who moved upon the face of the deep. Having gradually built all of this structure into a consistent pattern, we find the solar logos gradually achieving maturity, producing what we might term today a structure in which the consciousness of the solar deity became permeating throughout the entire area. From that time on, the solar deity gradually took hold of its own body, as we do in growing up, until finally the body became a complete agent for his purpose, for the unfoldment of the various forms of life. Each form of life unfolded from a collective superior to itself. Thus, for instance, from a planetary deity unfolded all the life of the planet. From a particular group type or racial type or species type unfold all of the separate manifestations of the different kingdoms of nature. They are all emanations by a completely rational process. They are all perfectly ordered and ordained. Now, the development of the solar system finally results in the emergence of a group of planets, all with their own evolving orders of life, all of them nourished by the one solar principle, all of them dependent upon solar consciousness for their consciousness, solar mind for their mind, solar emotion for their emotion, and solar energy for the preservation of their bodies. All of these energies are principles, only the body is a receptacle and not a principle. So all these various energies finally become embodied, and in so doing, gain ways of manifestation. When they are not embodied, they are not in manifestation. So man gains the power to perfect himself in arts and crafts and skills through the process of embodiment. And through this process, he learns the particular lesson of the great solar field of which he is a part. For the solar power itself has impressed a purpose upon the entire procedure, and all creatures within that solar system are gradually moving to the fulfillment of that purpose. Now, there's one other step in this which is intriguing and a little more difficult, perhaps, but still worth making a try at in connection with this procedure. A man, at various times in his own life, experiences qualities or changes within his own nature. He finds, for example, that under certain conditions, he is inclined to attempt to improve his nature. He attempts to discipline himself. He attempts to gradually integrate his own purposes. Now, we have to realize that as man is born, grows up, passes through childhood, adolescence, and early maturity, and comes finally to the maximum use of his facilities, he still has something else he has to do. And that is, he has to direct and dedicate his efforts to purposes that are proper and appropriate to him. Now, in the solar procedure, something of this nature occurs. It is hard to attempt to define it in such magnitudes as you would find in a solar system, but we still have the same principle involved, namely that the solar logos, or the creating power, using the entire solar system as its physical, emotional, vital, and mental organism, becomes like the compound individual, a series of bodies, a series of factors and forces. We have solar mind, and solar mind, while it is a great mind and an exalted mind, is not perfect mind. The same with all the other elements. A solar system in the great pattern of things is comparatively imperfect, and it is also even more imperfect when its ruling power has become obscured by the principles of matter. In other words, as it has descended into matter in a kind of symbolic fall, it has lost a certain amount of its own clarity, a certain amount of its own internal comprehension. It must regain this inner comprehension by means of a resurrection. And this resurrection, which is the raising of the dead, is nothing more or less than the release of consciousness from the sepulcher of matter, or of ignorance, of form, of the vibratory pattern which has closed in and limited or reduced the effectiveness of life itself. Now, resurrection being the restoration of consciousness simply means the restoring of the total consciousness of the solar being, and the equivalent in the solar being to what we would term illumination. In other words, this being restored to its own nature, restored to its own full consciousness, attains illumination, a symbolism which we find beautifully developed in the northern system of Buddhism. Here we recognize that the great powers, the Dhyana Buddhas particularly, also pass into samadhi, or pass into a state of meditation. And in this state of meditation, they also achieve an illumination. That there has to be also the awakening of the solar deity itself. This awakening is due in part to the production in nature of forms capable of releasing the higher forms of solar consciousness. Man at the present time is regarded as the creature possessing the most immediate resources for the liberation and restoration of the solar consciousness. This becomes, therefore, part of the secret rituals of the ancient mystery rites, namely, that the dying god dies in man, and that the resurrection takes place by the release of solar consciousness through man. That as fast as this consciousness is released, it is available again to the total experience, and that through this mysterious procedure, the solar being awakens, passing from its own kind of ignorance to its own kind of total enlightenment for itself. In order to achieve this, the solar being subjects its various bodies to discipline. And this is a very interesting point. Just as man, seeking enlightenment or seeking to advance in spiritual insight, must impose certain rules and regulations upon himself for the advancement of his own character and the perfection thereof, so, according to the ancient philosophies, the solar logos, having become embodied, having entered into the chaos of infinite potential, having been immersed or drowned or died in matter, as its consciousness unfolds by evolution, just as man's consciousness unfolds by the evolutionary process, it reaches the point in its development in which it recognizes the necessity of imposing self-rulership upon self. This experience, of course, is discovered, as Buddha points out, very largely to the Logos by man himself. Man is the one who experiences God's need for discipline. He is the one that realizes in mysterious way that by discipline or by the integration of his resources, he grows or becomes greater, or his consciousness is subject to illumination. This illumination of consciousness is a release, actually, not of man's consciousness, which is only a fragment of the solar consciousness, but the release of the solar consciousness itself. Thus, every being that arrives at illumination releases a part of the solar consciousness. And the bodhisattvas, who will not accept the nirvana until the least of all creatures is illumined, represents the consciousness or realization that the perfection of the great being or deity who projected the world is achieved only when every creature in it attains liberation. When that is attained, then the being itself is liberated. Then the mysterious Prometheus, who was crucified for bringing light to man, is released from the rocky crag of Mount Caucasus. Then and then only is the resurrection of the Logos achieved. Then only is the restoration of the Golden Age made possible. To attain this, therefore, what happens? The individual going out in life seeks teaching, seeks help, and finds that something has been seeking him at the same time. This thing that has been seeking him is the great order of world saviors. This order of world saviors represents the release from within the solar deity of the powers of enlightenment which were also locked within it. For as Buddhism points out, when the great being went to sleep in the previous embodiment, it took into sleep with it the dedicated sages. It took into sleep with it the arhats, the ones who must guard the world during the intervals between Buddhas. It took into sleep with it the bodhisattvas and the liberated ones, the dedicated ones, and also the great Buddhas of compassion. These were the spiritual force, the moral character, the insight of the solar logos. And when it began to emerge and unfold again here, when a certain degree of evolution was attained in the structure of the solar system, these various orders of sages began to embody also. These teachers that had also slept in rest in the divine mind until a certain point of evolution was accomplished, were released by the fact that it was then proper for man to be able to comprehend them. As unfolding mind in the solar system became capable of understanding, that which was necessary for that mind to understand was released from the divine mind. And this process kept on and keeps on continuously. For within the hierarchy of the solar logos must rest all of the forces and powers actually required to achieve the ultimate liberation of the logos. If such were not the case, then the power of crystallization would take over and we would have dead ends. We would have things that can never go anywhere. But always in the divine nature, there can be no dead end. For that which is actually the solar consciousness in its fullness is capable at all times of absolutely controlling or determining the ends of its own creation process. But this controlling power is not available at all times. It is not available until it is released gradually through the evolution of creatures. But this evolution is inevitable. Therefore, as time goes on, the problems get more complicated because faculties and natures become more complicated. But always with this complication, the faculties become richer in their power to comprehend, and more to comprehend is released in the form of the incarnation of these hierarchs of teachers. So that actually, the government of the solar system is entrusted really to three forces. It is entrusted to three powers which are expressions of the consciousness of the Logos. It is entrusted first to the Manus, the great lawgivers. The lawgivers being the exactitude of the solar mind. The solar mind, in the beginning, when it first contemplated absorption into creation, trusted its entire future upon the laws. These laws were a mysterious network of inevitables. These inevitables extended throughout all space, far beyond solar systems and galaxies and cosmic orders. These laws were the very laws of the substances of space which consciousness must work with. Therefore, when the great power went to sleep, it went to sleep in the law. It went to sleep with the perfect certainty that the tides of eternity would bring it finally back again to its natural estate. There could be no doubt of this. It had absolute and complete faith, because this faith was grounded in these eternal principles. And to these eternal principles, it turned over the administration of itself during its ages of sleep. And these principles became its unconscious leaders. They became its inevitable will guardians. They were the will powers of deity. And these were the great and inevitable lawgivers. Then the second order of protection that was given was what has been called the Lords of the Heart Doctrine. The Lords of the Heart Doctrine represented the entire gamut of human idealistic conception. All religions, all ideals, all hopes, all faiths, all beauties, all of the great creative arts, everything that inevitably must lead to the perfection of human insight in terms of faith and adoration, beauty, veneration, respect. All of these powers were invested in the Lords of the Heart Doctrine, who were the ones that became the shepherds of men. They were the ones who had to administer love before there were hearts to feel it. They were the ones who had to bring out of the growth of things in their strivings and their struggles and in the terrible chemistries of space, had to finally bring forth natural and kindly regards. From them also came the great patient teachers of human benevolence, the saints and the martyrs, all who gave all of themselves by an instinct which they cannot completely rationalize to the service of mankind. But all such dedicated persons are actually seed lives that were carried over by the Logos at the time it took on embodiment. They were not all fashioned here, but some were fashioned here. And in Buddhism, they are differentiated into two orders, therefore, the celestial bodhisattvas and the terrestrial bodhisattvas. The celestial bodhisattvas are the teachers that were brought over from the previous cycle. The terrestrial bodhisattvas, the dedicated disciples who rose here to carry on the work of these teachers. And these two orders work together. As soon as the terrestrial powers, or bodhisattvas, become strong enough, the celestial ones will retire from operation, but only when the world is able psychically, emotionally, and spiritually, and aesthetically, and culturally to sustain itself. The third order of the protectors and so forth were the basis of the scientific and civil administrative powers of mankind. Like the saints and the seers, these also were carried over. There are orders of intellects that were derived from other patterns of life, such as the great philosophers, also the great scientists. And one of the reasons why in evolution we pass from one age to another is because as we evolve, waves of life that have been held in suspension until the environment for them was appropriate come in and contribute their part to the direction of the entire pattern. This coming in of lives that have previously not been present merely means a calling upon other resources within the nature of the solar power itself. All of these principles are within that solar power. All of them were tied into the creation process by the impregnation of space within the sphere of solar creation. All of them were parts of the solar nature, just as all energies in life are part of the wealth which we receive from the sun. And as the symbolism of the sun shows nourishment to all things according to their needs, so these sun nourishment principles become embodied as the various deities of the ancient pantheons and the ancient philosophical systems. This is the reason for the elaborate structure of the Shingon mandaras in Japanese Buddhism. These thousands of deities, and in some instances tens of thousands of deities, all represent nothing but the individualization of the energy of the sun. They are all manifestations of some quality of Dainichi Nyori, or the great Buddha Virakana. Actually, therefore, just as every color that we see comes from the sun's light, just as every flavor that we can taste, every odor that we smell, everything that we touch is only a form of sun energy or sun structure. So actually, according to this philosophy, these germinal rays of the sun, forever pouring into the abyss or the vacuum to fill it, will be represented by not only faculties or powers or circumstances or growths, but also as spiritual living beings. They represent the creative energies as specialized beings. In the ancient system, there was no energy that was not embodied in something. There was no mere electricity flying through space from the sun to some human being or to some other structure. All this energy was in the form of hierarchs. It was in the form of evolving lives that were the particular channels of this energy. And these evolving lives brought the energies into manifestation with them, held them in manifestation, and finally, when their purposes are finished, these energies are withdrawn and these hierarchies retire again into the eternal nature. In the illumination of Buddha, we find the symbolism of the great teacher surrounded by the hierarchs. We find him in the presence of all the Buddhas of previous cycles. We find him attended by celestial beings. And in the Lotus of the Law, which is the great Mahayana scripture, we find an audience composed even of friendly and kindly associates who for the great enlightenment have come in from other solar systems to be present, not to interfere, but to rejoice in the fact that a great circumstance is occurring in nature, that a great power is being released in the evolution of things, and these gatherings for the release of great good may be considered sort of solar or cosmic holidays. They are days when all the universe rejoices, inasmuch as another phase of the great consciousness of Dainichi Nyori has been released into manifestation. When all this evolutionary process has reached a certain degree of unfoldment, little by little all lives begin to flow back again into the consciousness of the cause. Their outflowing was to lose consciousness, to become unaware of their source, therefore to wander in darkness until the life and character in themselves, longing for reunion with reality, impel them to begin the arduous journey to self-enlightenment. But in the great motion back in evolution in the solar system is simply a continuous process of awakening. It is a process of lives becoming more and more conscious of realities. And that the highest solar reality is the Logos, or the power at the source of solar existence. As all the parts of the solar system become aware of this, they return to it, which is, of course, underlying the Buddhist concept of the Parinirvana. For the Parinirvana is simply the hierarchies returning home to the great spiritual orders to which they belonged, as we also see in the magnificent spectacle of the hierarchs on the petals of the great rose in Dante's Paradiso. Actually, all these hierarchies returning home restore the consciousness of the Sola Logos in Shingon Dainichi Nyori. When they have all come back, when all divided consciousness has experienced again unity, when all divided parts have been drawn together in the indissolvable bonds of insight, the energies slowly become again what they were in the beginning. They retire from the many to the 12, from the 12 to the 7 to the 3, and the 3 return again to the 1. And when they have all returned again to the 1, the solar system has completed a lifetime. At that time, having regained its consciousness, enriched by the tremendous pageantry of growth which has occurred within it during its cycle, the Sola Logos awakens from embodiment. It is released from body as man is released from body. But as man, according to the ancient mysteries, may be released in two ways. We have the same principle involved in this. There is a form of death in which the body is separated from the soul. And there is also a form of death in which the soul, rising, separates itself from the body. And in the philosophical mysteries, the return of these conscious powers under the dedication of discipline, the transformation of men and creatures into avatars, into arhats, into sages. All this means the gradual return of life as consciousness, becoming more and more aware both of itself and of its great overlife. Finally, they all come together again in the consciousness of Dainichi. Then the globe and all that it inhabit disappears. Then the rings go back. Everything slowly reverses itself until nothing remains again but the imperishable island floating upon the surface of unconditioned space. Then at last this imperishable island does not perish, but vanishes into subjectivity, where it remains until the next cycle of embodiment is proper and natural. The Logos then goes to sleep again for the 7 eternities. This is going on constantly in space, according to the ancients. In Buddhist philosophy, the Buddhas and the great principles, the spiritual powers of tens of thousands of myriads of universes, attend in the great rejoicing when one of the solar systems is completed and one of these great cycles comes to an end. But this cycle again is of course part of a larger one. The solar deity, in passing into sleep, contributes to the evolution of the universal deity around whose nature many solar systems rotate. And the universal deity in turn, with all its solar systems and all its parts, is part of a galaxy or a still greater pattern, which again is reaffirming itself. But as all these things are continually reaffirming, the ancients held that in the ultimate or in the final nature of things, which is utterly beyond our conception, inconceivable to us, that everything consists finally of evolution causing things to wake up. And that ultimately, the total experience of everything is therefore to be total, to be aware, to wake up. And in this awaking, to wake up as infinity, to wake up as pure divine consciousness, to wake up as the administrator or the ruler of the great sea of space, and after having awakened, to take on again in some way the dream of illusion in order to advance other areas, other factors. For as surely as illumination is eternal and inevitable, so that those elements or patterns which are created are likewise eternal and innumerable. And we have to also realize that at various stages in this procedure, living things themselves become seminal. That is, they become seeds. And at certain periods of their development, the creatures of the various hierarchies bring new waves of life or new sparks of life into manifestation, which must go through the great cycle in space. We may agree with the Brahmins and we may agree with the Buddhists that it's all very abstract. We must agree with them that we do not have the answers to the infinites. But I think it is interesting to conceive, as far as we can go, the majesty of this concept. A concept which, it seems to me, by some mysterious and wonderful grasp of insight, transcends the noblest and most extravagant fantasies of science, transcends anything that we can imagine. For it not only gives us this infinite majesty of purpose, it gives us the infinite scientific unfoldment of things under law and under consciousness, but it also preserves a tremendous pattern of divine purposes, of great spiritual beings and great spiritual centers of consciousness, constantly and inevitably fulfilling their proper destinies in space. It is a very large concept. Naturally, we cannot grasp it all, but the small fragment that has been grasped has become the basis of most of the world's enlightened philosophies and has stood the test of human experience better than any system upon a less substantial foundation. And so with this, perhaps, as a basis, we can proceed to further phases of the ancient concepts of creation as they are found in the old teachings. Well, I think that's enough for this evening, and thank you very much.